not an exception. In other words, the prevailing morality reflects an inability to judge based on the truth. This ties into how the United States has distorted the truth, preached lies, and normalized them through a system of neuropirates. Essentially, there is a cognitive attack, a systematic propaganda war that began with Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Propaganda is everywhere for the United States. Selling a war is no different from selling a product. It has alienated and infantilized a society that has allowed itself to be infantilized, as consumption is essentially the ability to make people desire everything immediately and accept anything, even the most outrageous and absurd things, because we're living in a delusion, in a fantasy. This is the global issue, the disconnection from reality and the power of propaganda, aided by technology, to make people believe that things are exactly the opposite of what they truly are. This is the real danger, as today war can be peace, lies can be truth, and vice versa. We find ourselves in an Orwellian world, perhaps even worse. As the advisor from the World Economic Forum in Davos pointed out, many naive individuals read Yuval Noah Harari, who advises Klaus Schwab and claims that humans are hackable animals. If this is the level of understanding, if this is how deeply the dignity of humanity is perceived, reducing it to such a condition, then anything is possible. This marks the beginning of our own enslavement, especially with artificial intelligence dominating humanity, which poses a real threat in the hands of those lacking morals, boundaries, and humanity. This is exactly what we are witnessing. Today, it is feasible to promote Tony Blair, a war criminal who advocated for this, to lead a corporation in Gaza built on the blood and ruins of the Palestinian people.
Absolutely. We're nearing the end. It's going by quickly.
Yes, propaganda, as my friend rightly points out. For instance, I was the first father of an American soldier, despite not being an American citizen, who went to war, traveling to the very place where he lost his life. When I returned to the United States and began speaking out against the war, explaining the reality of Iraq in schools at that time, that's when the government's propaganda machine started to twist the news. They depicted me as a traitor, an ungrateful one, the person who disrespects his deceased son, who is regarded as a hero for the United States. This propaganda doesn't just affect me. It has impacted for about 23 years now this new generation that is currently on the streets attacking migrants, those who cover their faces in an attempt to, as they claim, cleanse the country. Let's look at history. What Hitler did, the new Hitler is doing the same. Trump, I mean, thanks to propaganda. It's very sad.
Gracias a la propaganda.
It's a wound that never heals. I can only imagine it's one of the worst things that can happen to a person. Typically, our children are meant to bury us, not the other way around. Do you have any final words?
Well, what I always tell students is that the best weapon against injustice, the best weapon against violence, is a book under your arm, reading, studying, respecting, and tolerating. Violence breeds violence and leads to death, while education fosters life. Thank you.
Oh, mountains of Mecca, what can you say of the day that Abraham passed your way, and he was instructed by God to build a house of peace where people will pray, and they will come on every lean camel and out of every ravine for the purpose of praising Allah to glorify.
Muhammad is his messenger. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah, Muhammad is his messenger.
Greetings, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's a preview of what's coming up next on your trusted radio station. Up first, take a moment for thoughtful reflection with Hadith of the Day. Next, we turn to Islamic laws with Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of the prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Following that, join us for Africa Today. For those seeking to deepen their connection with the Holy Quran, don't miss Let's Recite the Quran. Coming up next, it's the Hadith of the Day. Stay tuned.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the Day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear listeners, salam. Welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. So what does it really mean to be a good person? We all want to be known as salih, righteous, upright. But what are the actual signs of a salih human being, a righteous human being? The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his holy progeny, told Imam Ali alayhi salam that, O Ali, the righteous person has three signs. He reforms his relationship with Allah through good deeds. He reforms his religion through knowledge. And he is pleased for people with what he is pleased for himself. Three clear markers. Three practical tests for anyone who seeks goodness. The first sign, reforming the bond with Allah through good deeds. We know that faith is not just belief in the heart, it's action, prayer, honesty, charity, patience, kindness, and caring for each other, and so on. All of them connect us to the divine, not one without the other. The Prophet is telling us, righteousness shows up in what you do, not just what you say. And the second sign is reforming religion with knowledge. Islam is not blind ritual. A righteous person learns, asks, reflects, and deepens their understanding. And knowledge keeps faith alive and prevents it from becoming empty tradition. You know that religion, Islam, for example, came to remove ignorance from, you know, all aspects of all manifestations of ignorance from the society. But unfortunately, you find some religious people who practice it ignorantly, and that's very ironic and wrong. And the third sign is loving for others what you love for yourself. This is the golden rule of Islam. is the test of sincerity. If you want dignity, safety, and kindness for yourself, then want it and work for it for others too. Modern psychology confirms these timeless principles. For example, good deeds and spirituality. The modern psychology says that, for example, studies show that people who engage in regular acts of kindness and a spiritual practice report higher happiness and resilience, depending on, you know, what they understand from it. Knowledge and growth. Neuroscience proves that lifelong learning keeps the brain sharp, adaptable, and open to changes. And ignorance, by contrast, shrinks possibilities. And also social research finds that communities where people treat each other with fairness and reciprocity have lower crime rates, stronger bonds, and better overall well-being. So it's as if modern science is only now discovering what the prophet taught centuries ago. So how can we live these three signs today? Okay, thank you for listening. May we all carry these three signs of righteousness in our daily journey. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We're going to talk about some of the jurisprudential, topics of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me begin this episode with this question, Sheikh, if you don't mind. What is the duty of a woman whose husband's income is gained through Islamically illicit and impermissible means? Does she need to get a divorce?
Well, divorce is not necessary. It is not advisable. It's not a solution to the problem. So she must never contemplate a divorce, right? So long as she is not certain that the particular money for or property she is using is illegitimate,
mm-hmm.
and gained illicitly by her husband, she is allowed to make use of that thing, whatever she is given. And of course, it's very difficult to be certain, 100% sure that the money given to the wife is haram. Maybe her husband is doing some haram or halal work, or maybe halal and haram work, both of them.
Yes.
So how does she know that the money given to her is haram? It's also not necessary for her to investigate or and to try to and to to understand,
yes,
that the money given to her is haram or halal. Okay, she must rest assured that the money she is given is halal. Okay, and of course, she when it comes to one's being certain, okay, she is obligated to refrain from using or benefiting from the money or property she is certain.
Yes.
If she is 100% sure that the money is given to her is as haram, it is necessary for her to avoid using or benefiting from that money.
Yes. Okay. Well, is it permissible to play frame drums, otherwise known as dafs,
okay,
at women-only gatherings? Let's say, for example, gatherings held for celebrating some feasts and festivals and festive religious ceremonies and weddings and religious services.
Well, there is a kind of controversy among scholars because of the narrations that have been passed on to the scholars. And there are various reports indicating that daf might be allowed, because in the past, for example, it's claimed, okay, that daf was played by some people in weddings and only by ladies in women-only gatherings. But when it comes to Ayatollah Khamenei's position, he is of the view that playing dafs,
yes,
in a way that causes one to be distanced from God, from Allah, and from spiritual and moral virtues, and to be drawn to sin and degradation is not allowed. Okay, and usually it tends to cause people to fall into some kind of sins.
Yes,
to be degraded. Yes, and not to mention the fact that it is not appropriate to play musical instruments on religious occasions and for celebrating the lives of the Prophet and his holy Ahl al-Bayt, even if the music is in line with canonic guidelines or the Sharia guidelines and can be deemed permissible.
Yes,
it is basically not appropriate, to be honest. Yes. And playing music is inconsistent with the sanctity and the holiness of their position, mm-hmm. and their status and, yes, their personages.
Yes. I see.
That's what the scholars have said. And not to mention also that even the custom of believers, the urf of the believers, do not accept such a thing.
Mm.
Playing music to celebrate the, for example, the birthdays of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and also the Imams.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/EM. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Shabid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature with Sheikh Shabid, of course, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Shabid, you know, sometimes it happens that some people gain illicit money somewhere, and yes, they gather and collect an amount of wealth. But a part of their conscience, in fact, you know, feels guilty, and then they think that as a way of compensation, they can find a Sayyid and pay a part or a charity from the same illicit money gained to just, as I said, to make up for, you know, their illicit money, basically. So is it permissible, actually, to offer this charity to a needy Sayyid this way?
Right. Of course, the answer is yes. Okay, it is permissible to offer this amount of money, which people generally term it as Radd Mazalim.
Yes.
Right? And people, okay, Shia Muslims know what Radd Mazalim means. It's a compound word used, it can be translated as charity, intended as compensation for wealth that one has illicitly appropriated or gained from any rightful owner. So if, for example, a person knows the owner from whom the money was illicitly obtained, it's necessary to return the money, right? But when the owner is not known and it's not possible to identify the owner, and the owner does not turn up, it's not even likely.
Yes.
So it's quite okay to return the money, the Radd Mazalim, to any poor Shia Muslims, whether that Shia Muslim is a Sayyid or a non-Sayyid. It makes no difference.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take another break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma صلي على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Shabid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Shabid, I asked you a question before the break regarding the illicit or illegitimately gained money given as a way of compensation, or rather madhalim, as you mentioned, as a kind of charity to a needy Sayyid. But what if there is some money actually found on the streets, let me say, like in the lanes or streets? Does the same rule apply to that? I mean, like, is it permissible to give this found money to a needy Sayyid?
Yes. Lost and found money, right?
Yes.
Lost and found money to a needy Sayyid. You're right. Well, of course, the answer is also in the affirmative. I should say, yes, it is permissible to give it to a Sayyid. It is charity. Of course, generally speaking, people know that giving charity to sadaqah is not permissible. But when this charity is wajib, like Zakat al-Fitr cannot be given to a poor Sayyid. And that is the Zakat of a non-Sayyid, that the Zakat al-Fitr of a non-Sayyid cannot be given to a Sayyid. Mm-hmm. And also the Zakat which non-Sayyid people, Shia Muslims, might give, they cannot give their Zakat to a Sayyid, right?
Right.
But this kind of charity, according to His Eminence, it is okay in the first place to give this found property. It could be money to a Sayyid. His Eminence says that the precaution, it's not an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
The precaution is to give it to a non-Sayyid person, charity. And this charity must be given on behalf of the owner. Assuming that the owner is Muslim, he has lost his property and he does not turn up. So we give that amount of money as charity on behalf of him, of the actual owner, to a Sayyid or a non-Sayyid. It's better to give it to a non-Sayyid.
But if you live in a non-Islamic country where the majority is supposed to be non-Muslim,
yes,
then
it doesn't make sense to give that money as charity on behalf of the non-Muslim owner.
Uh-huh.
They do not believe in such a thing. They are not Muslims. They do not.
That's the point.
Yeah, that's the point.
Okay, and so what should they do?
The thing is that the scholars, the religious authorities have said that it's better to give it to a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
not even intending to eat as a charity, because the charity should be given on behalf of the owner.
I see.
So it should be given to a needy Shia Muslim. And if a person wants to pick it up for himself, it's also even pick up when it's not likely, when it's not possible to find the owner. If the owner is non-Muslim and it's very much likely that you might find him, you have to look for him, give it to him, to the rightful owner. Be he Muslim or a non-Muslim, it makes no difference.
Isn't it necessary actually to publicly announce it? Like, for example, to have some ads and stick it to walls and trees and everywhere? Like, for example, there is some money found? Like, even in a non-Muslim country?
Of course, it is. It's when something is of a value which is more than one dinar, right?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Okay, we know that one dinar probably could be, could be like $1, right?
Right.
If it's like $1, you don't have to make an announcement because it will be very costly for you to announce. But if it's more than that, you have to make an announcement.
Yes.
And when the owner is not
found,
then it is, then you should give it to the owner.
Thank you very much, Javed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. From the rest of the crew, we wish you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو الوحيد القدير. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the U.S. closes door, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening them. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs war imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world, This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the global south. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Ireti Bakare Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chiguka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration, basically because Africa is the richest continent on earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales, but if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, et cetera. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as fools, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and the imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chibuka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs, to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AFCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly we should get away. And I can't say, I mean, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually denying the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. I must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
Definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people to for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states. And also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.?
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was the reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms, so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive, because the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust, or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to respond effectively. While some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes, Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on the until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guests today, Ireti Bakari Yusuf and Zizwe Chuguka, for their incisive analysis. Now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant cultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Jana Tali, will share more on this.
Hello, I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. Songhai Empire, one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it's also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Askia Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system based on Islamic law. Under Askia Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade, dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. In 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tondibi marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. The That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Jannat Ali, it's goodbye for now.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the